In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It is me, Eric Williams, and this week we have my hero, the incredible Gary Jannetty. But first, here's today's thing you didn't know was gay. It's Granny Smith apples. That's right, Granny Smith apples, named after Granny Smith, the first person to ever call someone a faggot. Turns out it was her grandson, who would later become the very famous Dwight D. Eisenhower, who, turns out, the D stands for doxypep. Granny Smith apples. They're tart, they're sweet, they love to be smothered in caramel, and they will keep you up until 2 in the morning watching YouTube clips of Marlon Mandel. Granny Smith apples. They're gay, and they're going to stay that way. It's time to get into this week's episode with Gary Jannetty. He is a TV writer, producer, and New York Times best-selling author. His new book, We Are Experiencing a Slight Delay, is incredible. And you've also seen his amazing work on Family Guy, which he's written for a million years, Will and Grace, and you probably follow him for the cunty tweets he posts across the internet. Enjoy this episode with someone I am absolutely obsessed with. Gary Jannetty. Gary Jannetty is on That's a Gay Ass Fooking Podcast, and I am sitting here with my dreams coming true. Gary, can I tell you something?
Yes, please.
She's got your books.
Thanks, Eric. I appreciate that.
Are you kidding?
That's so great.
I am so excited to have you on this podcast, and I want to get into the Brad of it all. I want to get into a lot. So are you buckled the brunch up?
Yeah, whatever. Just ask me whatever you want. I don't care.
Again, dreams are coming true. Now, Gary, yes. You have written all these books I love. You've written on so many shows that I love. But I want to ask you, I like to go controversial to start.
Okay, great.
You say the perfect amount of time for a trip is 2 weeks. However, you have to leave for a trip this weekend. Gary Jannetty, where is she going?
I have to leave this weekend. Where am I going?
For 2 weeks.
London and Paris.
See, this is why we need to have a tete-a-tete, because am I doing London wrong? Every time I've gone, I say to myself, we love a West End, we love an Indian food, but why do I not feel the need to return?
Oh.
What am I doing wrong?
I don't know. I don't know, Eric, but definitely something. Yeah, definitely. You know, maybe it's not your vibe, I guess.
Well, what's the vibe that you enjoy about it?
What's the vibe that I mean, I don't know. I feel like I just got here and I have to defend London. I mean, like, I feel like London can do okay without me needing to defend it. It's not Pittsburgh, you know, so I don't feel like I have to.
Okay,
nothing,
Gary,
against Pittsburgh, by the way.
My goddamn mom grew up in Squirrel Hill.
Of course
How
she did.
Dare you?
Of course she did. Yeah, you probably prefer that to London, so there you go.
Do you like how
go
I brought you on?
Squirrel Hill.
I compliment you within 2 minutes, we're immediately fighting. I think this is how we know it's a gay podcast. So how dare you? You know what? London hasn't.
Who do you think you are? I don't need to, Eric. I don't need to tell you what's good about fucking London. So I mean, you know, I don't know what to say.
And I appreciate the candor of which you have clapped back on defense of London. But let's get into a more love-filled conversation when we talk about you meeting Brad in Mykonos. This is where, and you don't need to defend any decisions you made when you did meet him, but I want to kind of glean from your expertise.
Sure.
You made out with him on the dance floor, 30 minutes after meeting is what I've read in this book.
Yeah, it would be
Were you always good at sealing the deal?
Was I always good at stealing the deal? You know, I don't know. I don't think so. No, I was good at, I think at a certain point I was good at not caring. Like I wasn't like, oh my God, what if I get rejected? Like I think I was very prissy like that in my 20s. Like, oh, but then once I hit 30, I was like, oh, I don't give a fuck. You know, like I was like, if I was attracted to somebody, it was very easy for me to let that be known. And if it was not reciprocated, I didn't care. I was like, okay,
you know. Good for you. So. I think that's the way to be, because I'm in this interesting era where I've been with Matt for 11 years. We were monog for 8 of those years. And so I'm learning that I would like to care less about rejection, but it's sometimes getting in the way of me being like, hey, you're hot. I'd like to make out. That to me feels dangerous in a way that I don't think it actually is dangerous.
Yeah, it's not. It's like also like, who cares? It's like, it's not a big deal. If somebody that you're attracted to isn't attracted to you, it's like you're not that invested in them anyway. You only were attracted to them for like the first minute. It's not like, oh my God, it's not earth shattering. It's
no,
really
that's
not
true.
A big deal.
It's true. It's also an interesting thing I find with gay guys as I'm getting older and growing like a gay circle is that there's the inevitable, do we want to fuck? I think we want to fuck, but are we just going to be friends who don't fuck? Are we going to be friends who fuck? Or is there a secret fourth thing? I think there's sometimes like that element with being a gay guy, but I don't know if you have the same experience.
You know, I mean, I've been in a relationship so long now. You know, we've been together for 23 years.
Gary, I will say that we are going to get a little bit more into the weeds of those 23 years, but okay, I think if we start individually, another quote you have in your book that I love is,
yes.
Only once I see that you are also fucked up will I ever start to relax. You connect with people who are letting their true freak flags fly. They are showing that they're not perfect. I'm very fucked up. What would you say categorically is the most fucked up thing about you?
That's a good question. What is the most fucked up thing? I think I can be very controlling. You know, I like to control a situation. I like to make things be the way I want them to be, the way I kind of, and sometimes that works, you know, for me. You know, I don't take no for an answer. I will constantly try to find my way to get, you know, things to work out the way I want them to work out, because I found that that's what I needed to do. You know, I mean, I came out during a different time than you did, Eric. And it was harder for gay people to break through in TV and all of that stuff. And I was always out. I was out, you know, since I was in college, and I was never in, like, I never hid anything about myself. And it was, I always had to kind of, you know, be better than everybody else, and you know, in a writer's room and in comedy and all of that. And I felt that I always had to kind of push myself harder, and I never took no for an answer. And I was always, you know, would kind of figure out a way. I was like, there's got to be a way. There's got to be a way. So sometimes it's hard for me to let go of that mentality, because sometimes you do come up against something and it's like, you know what? No, this is not happening. And you have to also know how to be okay with that too.
Well, it's an interesting point, because I think especially when you, like you're saying, are coming up in an era where it's not acceptable or safe or okay to be gay, you come up with defense mechanisms. And then as an older person, the older you get, you have to decide what defense mechanisms are serving you. I do that with my therapist now, of like when my body goes into fight or flight, when I'm trying to just fucking write something new. And instead of my body telling me that you're not safe to create because, you know, being gay, where I grew up in fucking St. Louis, Missouri, where I did not feel safe to be my gay faggotrini self, but I'm still trying to divorce myself from some of the defenses I've come up with, but also like some of the controlling things that you have and not taking no for an answer. I'm sure it still is serving you in some ways.
Yeah, but, you know, exactly. So it is, I think a lot of those things that we had to those kind of coping mechanisms that we had to develop when we're young, you know, to, you know, survive and to protect ourselves, can in many ways serve you, at, you know, as you enter into your formative years, your adulthood, your careers, etc. And obviously you don't recognize it at the time, but they do kind of give you certain skills.
Well, isn't there that whole thing about gay people that's like the best little boy's mentality, or it's like we have to be better. And we have to be the best at the other things to take the attention away from maybe the thing that is not acceptable. So, I mean, you truly had to exemplify that with, I'm sure, a lot of the writers' rooms you were in or people you were with were just like a lot of straight guys.
Yeah. Well, you know, I also was lucky on Family Guy when I first started. There was actually a joke. It lasted on the show for a couple of years because when I first started, I started on it from the first episode, which is like 25 years ago. And that, I remember the first day in the writer's room, I think I came like a few days after, like a week after everybody else had already started, because people were kind of joining the show gradually. And when I got there, it's like, you know, you're just thrown in, you're in the room or going, and I was like, oh, there are other gay people here. I thought that I pegged. It was all men, by the way. It was all white men. And I was like, there are four guys that are gay on the show. I was like, yay. This is the first time I've ever been. There were four. And then systematically, as the week went on, one thing would come. Somebody would be like, my girlfriend, or I'm going to my wife. And I would be like, oh. So these four guys, I found out, were all straight, but I had thought they were all gay. And then I told them eventually on the show. I was like, I thought four of you were gay, but I never told anybody who they were. And they were called the Jannetty Four, because people would always try to guess. And I said, if anybody ever guessed all four of them correctly, I would then say that's what it was. But otherwise, and it was a couple of years before somebody actually did guess it correctly or something. But yeah, so I was the only gay guy in a room of, like, I don't know, 15 straight guys.
And, well, you eventually found out you were the only gay guy, but I love that you've created your own reality show competition of who does Gary think is gay?
I know. It became this obsession. It was like, who are they? And people wanted to be in it. It was a great group of people, though. I was very fortunate. It was not...
Well, it's clear the show is so... I mean, it's so funny. And I think to pit straight people against each other about who do we think is gay is a very beautiful way to turn the tables as an adult. So God bless. Like, it's funny that Family Guy, it's such a straight-coded show in many ways, but it's also very queer. And so I feel like seeing these straight guys, assuming they were gay, was it that they dressed better? Were they just nice people? Sometimes I think a straight guy is gay just because he treats me with respect.
Yeah. It was actually, for all four of them, it was different things. So it wasn't dressing well for any of them. So no, I was the only one who like came in, you know, pulled together. And
what about Seth MacFarlane? To me, he's like obviously a straight guy, but he has a deep love for the musical theater. Yeah. Like he's a guy that I feel
he's super gay friendly. Like we clicked very well early on because a lot of the things that he was interested in exploring and writing about and doing these, you know, bringing in these musical numbers from The Music Man and The Sound of Music into this show in these kind of fresh ways and really unexpected ways. It was something that I gravitated towards instantly.
I don't know the guy, but I know that I would feel safe in a room having a Broadway conversation with that straight man.
Yeah, totally, 100%.
Well, since this is a gay-ass podcast, Gary Jannetty, I do have to ask you the famous podcast question, which is, whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
it's like there are so many, but I think, for me, a very pivotal person was Stephen Carrington on Dynasty, you know? I mean, I was fixated on that. Up until that time, gay people were always the butt of the joke, or there was some, you know, there was something that was, we were laughing at them, or they were an object of pity. Whereas when Stephen Carrington, and I was a kid when that came out, and he was, you know, all American and very... good looking. But he was also, you know, and obviously, if you know Dynasty or if you're, you know, please don't come for me. I know it was problematic. It was the fucking 80s. But he was what he was that I had never seen anybody be before. He was defiant. Mm. There was something, and it was thrilling to me. Like, he stood up to his father. He didn't cow in that first year. I mean, his father accidentally kills his lover. They have a fight, and he, you know, and that's the murder trial that ends up going on in the first season. But he was defiant, and that was like, holy shit. And I also thought, I mean, to me, I didn't know any other gay people at this time. You know, I lived in my head. I lived always, you know, imagining and shutting things down and then opening things up and obsessed with so many of the things that so many of us are obsessed with. But that told me something, gave me information at a really pivotal time in my life. I thought, if they are creating, if this popular ABC nighttime soap opera, if one of their main characters is gay, there must be a lot of us.
Oh.
I was like, there are a lot of us out there. It gave me information that I needed because I had assumed it. You know, I always just assumed if I'm gay, I have to wait, bide my time until I find my people. But when I saw that on Dynasty, I was like, oh God, there are tons of us out there.
And we're all watching this guy.
And we're starting to come through. I had this sense that there was a kind of shift happening.
Do you remember at what age you were having this kind of thought process watching Steven?
God, I would have been like 12 years old or something. But even earlier than that, I mean, I went to Catholic school and I was also fortunate that I was never taught anything negative about gays ever in my 12 years of school. And whenever it came up, it was actually very matter of fact. I think it was a time because nobody was really looking at it the way they look at it now. So nobody really had to kind of get on one side versus the other. They could be just kind of matter of fact in a way.
They didn't think the gay problem was going to become what it was, which is us.
Or they didn't seem to care too terribly, at least where I went to school. But I also, I kind of always had this sense that any time I heard anything that was not supportive about gay, you know, anything at all, I always knew, I intrinsically knew that it was wrong.
Do you think the New York of it all was even like in the walls of the buildings you were in, they were whispering to you like, everybody's gay. Everybody's gay.
I definitely think growing up in New York City, I mean, I was Queens. I didn't grow up in Manhattan. I didn't even know people lived in Manhattan until I was in, like, college. I was like, they live there? You know, I definitely think that helped to be in, you know, this nexus of, you know, where there was. I mean, I was going into Manhattan to see Broadway matinees from the time I was like 11 or 12.
Oh,
so,
and God, I, you know, bless.
So it really, I could see the world that I wasn't going to be in for a while yet, but I could see that there's something existed. There was a very faint light at the end of the tunnel, I think.
Oh, 100. I don't really have any regrets about my journey of coming out, or because I didn't go to New York City for the first time until I was 17 years old. I went on a trip and I ended up going to college there, and just like my world did explode when I got to see all of the Broadway and the gay and the boo. But I think that for when I look at people like you who did get to grow up just seeing a bit more of it, I can see how there would have been more of a confirmation that gay people exist. Whereas for me, I only knew Ernesto, who cut my hair. And then the one guy who was a year above me who would like grope the straight guys and make them uncomfortable. So I was kind of like, okay, if these are my options, I'm horrible with scissors and I don't want to go to prison. But you have to give a gay like me at least one or two Broadway shows you saw growing up that you will not forget. Were there any Broadway shows that you would go and that stuck with you?
Totally. Oh my God. Well, A Chorus Line was huge, you know, because A Chorus Line I wrote about it in my second book, but I saw it so many times over the course of its run, and it always meant something kind of different. Each time I kind of took something different away for it. I mean, now I can't see it without crying. There's something so, you know, pure and beautiful about it. At the time when I when I first saw it, it was even beyond aspirational, Eric. I couldn't imagine how successful you would have to be to even get to audition for a Broadway show. To me, just auditioning for a Broadway show meant you were already, you know, the most successful person in the world.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, as I got older, I recognized, oh my God, you know, the kind of tragedy mixed into it. And it's like how these people are struggling to just stay in the chorus. And then by the time I hit 50, I went back to the same way I was when I first saw it when I was 12, which is like, how beautiful. These are the most successful people in the world. You know, it's like, of course they are. They're following their dream. They have something that they love, and they are doing it, and that's all any of us can hope to do. And it went back to being as pure as it was, you know, the first time I saw it. I almost became cynical at a certain point in my career when I saw it again when I was 40 something, and I was on the revival on Broadway, and I was like, oh my God, I was so stupid when I was young. I thought they were so successful, and they're barely scraping by. These are people who's barely were in the chorus, you know. They don't have anything. They're not. Once they're 30, they'll age out of this whole thing. And look at Cassie. And then it came back around, you know.
Look at Cassie. I talk a lot of shit about musical theater because I used to do it, you know, as an actor, and it really is so fucked up how just like how hard it is on your body, the amount of money you make. But it does, there is a reason why it is still prevailing as like one of the best art forms, because there's something, it's unlike anything else. I mean, I know at this point it's now everybody's talking about it so much that it will seem hack, but like the Oh Mary of it all. Have you been able to see Cola's Cola's?
Yeah, of course. It's brilliant.
Brilliant. Yeah. It's just like, I watched that just thinking like, this is the magic that no matter what is the reality about working in theater or like how fucked up the industry can be, like when you witness something like that play, it's like your whole body is like, everything is firing.
Cola's the real deal. And I think that there are a lot of people, you know, I think that there are people, we've all seen the kind of things that are just take shortcuts to, you know, like words that just have, you know, we're going to just say these words and repeat them because it's fun, you know, it's a funny word where there's no artistry to it, you know. And there used to be, you know, when I moved to the city first, see Charles Ludlam and the Ridiculous Theatrical Company and Vampire Lesbians of Sodom and all of those shows, which this is kind of hearkening back to, but yet also wholly original and also wholly specifically Cole and of today. And I've laughed more during that show than I had in so long.
Yeah.
It reminded me of what it was like when I was in my 20s and seeing those shows.
Well, you're saying that the truth is that Cole has put the work in over the years to develop this voice.
It's hard.
It's
very hard.
Well, it's funny. It's, like, you know, you watch it where sometimes you're like, you know how hard it is, but then you see Cole doing it in seemingly effortless ways.
Of course, and that's like, what's so hard, to make something so hard look easy. I mean, also, you have to have a point of view. You have to have something to say. You have to have, you know, a way you're approaching something. And it's so to see them being rewarded with the success that they're having now on Broadway and the run being extended. I'll be seeing it again. But it just made me so happy seeing that show. I thought it was brilliant.
Oh, brilliant! I also love. The final thing about Cole is that they're like, even on their press interviews, just being so themselves in wackadoo. And they were recently on Watch What Happens Live, giving it back to Andy in the most beautiful way. And I'm going to use that as a segue to talk about your recent appearance on Watch What Happens with New Jersey housewife Jen Aden.
I love that you saw that. We're going to be talking about it.
Gary, I saw it. And I also saw one of those fucking websites that loves to dig up the dirt that Tamra and Teddy Mellencamp are saying about the goings on. And they had something to say about your appearance on Watch What Happens. Tamra Judge said, quote, Jen Aden would not shut the fuck up. Teddy expressed disappointment that you did not have much of a chance to speak. She said, the part that really kind of got to me is Gary Jannetty is really funny. He's hilarious. And she wouldn't let him get a freaking... Even Andy had to say, let me get a word in, please. Did you feel that from Jen? Or were you fine with the correspondence?
Yeah, you know, I knew we met before, you know, we went on the show, and I was like, oh, this is going to be challenging. But I will say this, like, no, I didn't feel that way. Like, being on the show, I also thought I was giving it back, and I was having fun, and we were being, she was also, in Jen's defense, she was like, she was open. She was very playful. She was not in any way, like, she didn't care what I said, and yeah. she was game. She might have been overly, probably nervous maybe because of what had been going on the show for that long and be there. Right. So I can give her like, no, I didn't care. I had fun being on the, I actually enjoyed that episode doing that. It was actually a lot of fun.
Well, you're the right type of person to do Watch What Happens. Cause you can see sometimes when people are there, have their deer in headlight eyes of just like, oh God, what they, you have to be quick and be able to return some of the insanity that is being asked of them. And I think you were always very game, but I am curious about, you know, you've now done Watch What Happens a bunch. You obviously are a big Bravo fan. What's your relationship with Andy? I mean, you are two gay guys who have come up in like an insane industry. You're both, I really respect both of you. Did you know him before he became like the Andy Cohen that he is now?
I did. I've known Andy for over 20 years, I guess now, maybe? No, about 18 years or something like that. We have mutual friends in common. One of his closest friends is one of my closest friends, is a very close friend, you know? So we have had friends in common. And then we've always kind of been on the periphery of each other in many ways. And when Brad did the Rachel Zoe project, it was, yeah, I mean, that was a long time ago now, I guess that was probably like 16, 17 years ago or something.
Wow.
So even then, Andy didn't know Brad was my boy. Like he had met him once before, maybe with me at some bigger kind of a thing. Yeah. But there was no, it was like, oh my God. It was like this, it's a small world when it ended up. Oh, Brad is Gary's boyfriend. But we weren't, yeah, so we always kind of knew each other. And then we become more friendly over the years.
Has he changed at all from being?
No.
Okay.
No. And Andy's terrific. Andy supports other gay artists. He has them on his show. He supports people in the community in a way that I think is terrific. And he's always supported me and had me on every day. Like he's kind of all, and he's always been like that. And he's the same. He has a sense of humor, I think, about himself and about the kind of business that he's in on Bravo. So,
well, you're very honest about the things that annoy you and your pet peeves. And my biggest pet peeve is when people take themselves too seriously. And I love that you, that Andy, like we're allowed to poke fun at ourselves. But also Andy Cohen is a St. Louis gay like I am. So we have to contractually say go Cardinals. Now you also have worked on so many shows that I would love to dig into, Gary. And one of those shows is infamous. It's a one-season wonder that I like to call Bette. Gary Jannetty.
Is it infamous? I didn't know it was infamous.
Well, it's coming up now in the Zeit.
It is? I'm on it twice. I play a flight attendant. I'm on two episodes.
A canonically gay role. Okay, well, the first question is, how did you get into the mind of a flight attendant?
I've flown a lot, so there you go.
So the reason why it's come up recently is that Bette Midler was on David Duchovny's Fail Better podcast, basically shitting on the sitcom of Bette. And she said, I did a television show, Bette. Does it get any more generic than that? A big, big, big mistake. I had made theatrical live events. I had made films. I had made variety television shows. I'd been on talk shows, but I had never done a situational comedy. I didn't realize what the pace was, and I didn't understand what the hierarchy was, and no one bothered to tell me. She then basically goes on to say that she was very pissed that Lindsay Lohan left the sitcom after the pilot. She goes, Lindsay Lohan decided she didn't want to do it, or she had other fish to fry. So Lindsay Lohan left the building
And I said, well, now what do you do? The studio didn't help me, blah, blah, blah. She goes, if I had been in my right mind, or if I'd known that my part of my duties was to stand up and say, this will absolutely not do, I'm going to sue, then I would have done that. Then she says that she was thrilled that it got canceled after one season. Do you remember, Bette, have any of this experience from your angle? I mean, you were what, the one of the writers and the executive producer
right.
on the show?
I was a co-EP, I believe.
Co-EP.
On the show.
So,
do you have any supervising producer? I don't even remember. Well, it wasn't my show. I was, you know, on the writing staff. But I personally remember wanting to do the show only because, or I should say mainly, but mostly because it was going to be filmed in New York. And I wanted to do a show in New York. I wanted to go back to New York. And I thought it would be exciting. We're going to do Bette Midler. We're going to film in New York. And I was like, yes. So I want to do it. And that's – so my memory is that Lindsay Lohan, the only reason she didn't do the show was because then the last minute – after I'd already taken the job, the showrunner, and I don't know, I hadn't met Bette at this point, but they decided to do it in L.A. instead of New York. And I was so bummed. I was like, so my memory is she couldn't. Her whole life was in New York. You know, she was a kid, so she wasn't going to be able to do the show in L.A., so they had to recast it. And obviously, she's such a special talent, and she was so good, so the show would have suffered from losing her. I mean, I knew it then. I was like, oh God, like now what I thought was going to be this is now this. So I was bummed we were filming in LA.
Oh, so is that why the show didn't continue on, was of losing?
I don't know why it didn't. I mean, I assume it didn't continue because of the ratings. And I know Bette wasn't happy doing the show. I got along well with her. I loved her. You know, and I thought, you know, she was terrific. It also wasn't my show, so I was kind of like, you know,
but that
I was a
me,
gun for hire.
Well, you inspire me in so many ways. I mean, I would love to following some of the things you've done with your writing, and of course playing a gay flight attendant is any gay person's dream. But is there anything you would do differently, or let's say you're looking at a gay guy like me who is trying to build this creative life, is there anything you would have done differently as you were growing in the industry, or is there any advice you wish you had been told as you were building?
You know, I think what's great that the way the industry has shifted now, what I love and what I think is terrific for you and for so many queer artists now is there is more of a vocabulary of how we can express ourselves. We can write, we can act, we can, you know, and there's so much more freedom in that and opportunity, even though it's obviously not extraordinary, it's still a lot more opportunity. And for me, you know, I had always wanted to also be a performer, but it was kind of like, what was I going to do? You know, that you really had to pick a lane. And I knew I was a better writer than I was a performer. I couldn't develop. If I went in and said, I want to develop a sitcom for myself about a gay guy, and they would have been, their heads would have exploded. It was like, you know, there had been, you know, nothing. So I kind of had to maneuver within what I had to work with.
Right.
But I will say this, my what I learned, and I kind of taught it to myself was, you know, trust your instincts. You know, I actually had taken shows that I was told were going to be successful. One of them was Bette, by the way. I was told by everybody around me, like, take this show, it's going to be a big hit. I wasn't that keen on it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like, oh my God. I was like, okay, but I was so young and it was such the infancy of my career that I listened to people. They were like, oh my God, this thing, you're going to be a part of this massive kind of next huge hit. Like everybody in town wants this job and you're being offered it. So, oh my God. Yeah. So you kind of get swept up in that. And then of course it's infamous, as you just said, but to go, you know, I was like, ugh, my instinct was I didn't want to do this. And I kind of got pushed into doing this. Obviously Bette had the same instinct. And, you know, and then cut to like a year, not even, it was actually came before it, weirdly. Family Guy was a show I did because I wanted to, you know, at the time, nobody had their eyes on Family Guy. Nobody had any expectations of it at all. Seth was the youngest showrunner, I think, in TV history at that point. I met with him. We really hit it off, and I wanted to do it, but nobody, they were like, okay, you know, whatever, blah, blah. Nobody was looking at that because this was like, it was not on anybody's radar. But my instinct was I didn't care because there were other things out there that might have been shinier that people were like, oh, but this and this. But I was like, I don't think those are funny. I want to do something that I think is funny and that I understand the language of that show from the very first little 6 minute or 7 minute kind of demo that I was shown before I met Seth. I was like, I want to do this. I think it's funny. I don't care. I'm doing it. And it wasn't until, by the way, years later that instinct was proven to be correct because the show was canceled twice. It wasn't until I was on Will and Grace that it came back from the dead again and, you know, became this the thing that it was. But it was, for years, I had felt like, it's okay, I did it, a small group of people liked it, I got to meet with these people, and I did the thing that I wanted to do, and I never, and then it ended up being like, thank God, you know, I had enough, I had that kind of presence of mind to be like, I just want to do what I think is funny. And I always think, that was a lesson that I'll never forget. I always am like, I just want to do what I want to do. And if it means I have different opportunities than I would have had if I had done other things, then that's okay. Because everything I do, I want it to be something that I feel like I stand behind and that I am able to get my voice through in the way that I want to.
Yeah, I think it's also a really big testament to the survival tactics you had to take about advocating for yourself and not taking no. Because in a way, we as gay people have to relearn how to trust our gut. I know I did when I was like told either I wasn't gay or whatever it was. And I think that inspires me because I oftentimes will feel a gut reaction to something and then get advice from someone else that is counter to that. And even if it's counter to my gut, if I go to take that person's advice and I'm hearing the alarm bells, I'll sometimes not as listen to my gut as much. But I mean, it happened to me the other day. I had a meeting with a guy about, I have this live show that we do for the podcast that's been successful and growing, and he was sort of telling me to point it in a direction that I knew my tummy wasn't feeling good about. And instead of listening to that, I finished the meeting and I was like, okay, I'm gonna do what he said. And then I talked to a couple of people and they're like, what are you talking about? Like, I still have to train myself to really trust my gut, because even like you're saying, it might take years for you to actually get that affirmation that it was the right choice, but it's way more important to follow your gay bliss than to, I don't know, take outside advice that is counter to what you actually believe in or just feel pulled
towards. Yeah, there's nothing worse than going against what you feel is right for you, and then, you know, you talk yourself into it somehow, and then now you're stuck doing it, and you have that feeling of like, oh God, I knew this was wrong. I allowed myself to be talked into the fact that it wasn't, and said, maybe you're being too, you know, blah, blah. You know, you're not thinking enough. Like, no, it's like you have to find it. You have to listen to it. It's like your own individual voice. I thought when I first started on Family Guy, and Stewie was just an evil genius, and the guys on the show were so good at that. It was very science fiction. It was very, there was something about it that was, it was all virtual reality and time machines and all of that kind of stuff. I didn't have that language. So when it came time for me to write the first episode, my episode of the show, I was like, I could try to write it like they're writing him, but I'll never do it as well because I'll be copying what they're already doing, and I'm not versed enough in it. I'm not excited about it. So I thought I can either do that or I can write him like a little bitch and just I'm like, I'm gonna have him talk the way I want him to talk, you know? And I went with that. I was like, I'm gonna write him like a petty little bitch.
And a little bitch is what he was. was.
You know, and fortunately, like every, but it was like at that time too, you know, when you're starting on a show, characters actually have to evolve and they have to incorporate different colors and all of that. And I was fortunate enough that Seth was like, I like this color, you know, this other way, this way of expanding, you know, who this character is. But had I not listened to that, had I said, oh no, that's just me forcing my thing onto it, and it's I'm jamming my thing onto this, and I shouldn't do that. I should do what's here. That's what I'm here for. I was like, fuck that, you know.
No, you colored with the crayons you were given.
Yeah, and I think that those are things that as gay people, you know, and as queer people, we have to, you know, remind ourselves. I still have to remind myself, by the way. It's not like it happens once and we don't have to relearn lessons over again.
Oh, Gary.
I'm always like, oh, here I am. I'm over 50 and I'm learning this lesson again. Like, you know, so you have to recognize that happens. These lessons, you know, repeat, you know.
Yeah. No, I'm learning that with every passing year, that you just have to continually do the work, as it were. But you've also done the work in your gorgeous gay relation with these 23 years with Brad Goresk. Now, I know his full name. I'm just abbreviating.
I know you are.
Okay, thank you. Just making sure. So the two of you and Brad have this beautiful long relationship. The way you talk about him in the book is, it brings tears to my eyes. It's so sweet. But I also love that you two are very different. I mean, you've described yourself as a snob. You've described Brad as like a friendly Canadian.
As a snob, part-time snob. Like, I'm not a snob. I make fun of, I'm from Queens and I love Queens and I'm very often in Queens.
Well, if you were
a true
snob, no one would actually want to root for you or read your shit.
You.
So I think it's like,
thanks, Sarah.
You have this beautiful balance of relatability while also saying quote unquote snobby opinions that we all feel intrinsically. I mean, that's the reason why I love reading it. But I myself am married to someone who is a beautiful soul, but also a total bitch. So my question is, you and Brad having these differences, Matt and I having these differences, has Brad always loved these quirks, or have you ever found that your differences were ever at odds with each other?
That's a good question. Not really. They haven't really. You know, we're 11 years apart. And when I met Brad, he was 23. Mm-hmm. And I had never met. And also, by the way, we met on vacation. Like, it's the, as you were mentioning, we met in Mykonos. And then he basically came home with me. And he hasn't left yet. You know, we always, you know, I said from the beginning, I was very honest. I was like, we're just going to take this as it comes one day at a time. I can't promise you anything because we just, but we're enjoying this. So let's, if we both agree to this, to see where it goes. But I had never met anybody like Brad who was such a sponge, like anything. Like, he was so great. Like, I would be, you know, and he was from Canada. He'd been working as a waiter and kind of, he'll say model, but he wasn't really a model. Show me, you know, the magazines, Brad. But I pulled him in. Suddenly he was here. We're going to an Emmy party for Will and Grace and would be in the car. And I'd be like, this is how you behave. These are the rules. This is how it goes, you know? And I'd be like, and I'd give him, and I'm like, and I'm not going to be talking to you the whole night. So I'm going to separate. So we're going to be like, I can't be with you the whole time. You're going to have to learn this. And these are the rules. And it's good. And it's going to be tricky. And you're going to have to kind of do it. And he was like, got it. And he was, you know,
Brad,
there's never been a better student than Brad. Every little thing. Because from when we first met, you know, I could take him into a Days in off a turnpike. And he'd be like, this is nice. Within a week, he checked into a hotel in Hawaii. And he was like, I don't think he's going to like this.
Yeah, the towels are a little too rough here.
Yeah, he was a perfect student, you know. He had it, as I say in the book, though, you can't bring it out if it's not already in there.
Yeah, I mean, no, that you that's the sign of a true, beautiful relationship, is pulling out the magic in the other. Listen, I can kvetch about Matt all the time, but he really is someone who has actual grounded ability to move through this planet with common sense. I could not be more dumb at times, and I'm very grateful for him for all those, for the things that we bring to the relationship. But I also think that, like, we are so different when it comes to, like, he came up repressed Catholic Georgia. I came up oversharing Jew Midwest. But like I think when I see relationships that last so long like yours has, it clearly has shown that you have developed a communication that is full of respect and also like growth, especially, I mean, all the places you visited. Like in this book, you talk about places in New York, Rome, Paris, Venice, Rio, Melbourne, Sydney, Mykonos, LA, and London, as we've discussed. But has there ever been a place that you have gone on a trip and you've had a very dumb fight with Brad that has overshadowed the trip?
Never that's overshadowed the trip, no. You know, I think I remember us having a fight early on in Paris once. I think I remember us shouting at each other on the sidewalk, and I only remember it because it's never happened before or since. You know, we don't fight a lot. We can be snippy with each other,
yeah.
But we know each other very well now, and we've never fought a lot. It's you know, when couples tell me like, oh my God, we fight all the time, but I guess that's what, you know, marriage is like or whatever, and I'm like, I don't think it is, actually. I think that's not a great
yeah,
sign.
No.
I'd rather be alone. I don't like fighting. It's, you know, not something I don't thrive on drama. I think it's not something I thrive on calm and just being like happy. We never fought much. I think what I knew early on, I just know myself enough that I knew when we first started going out, the trick was I already had an established career and Brad didn't. And I was afraid if he was coming to live in LA, he was just going to be adjacent to my life. His life would be he would forever be, you know, Gary's plus one, you know, and I was worried about that because I knew A, I would lose interest, and I also knew B, that wouldn't ultimately be satisfying, and I knew that time goes by quickly, that, you know, because I had 11 years on him, and I was like, you think this is great now, but life isn't about restaurants and going and planning nice trips, you know, because you're going to blink and you're going to be 33, and what will you, you know, what did you accomplish outside of that in that time? You need to, it is a way of saying, I'm like, you need to have your own individual life. You need to pursue your dream, what it is you want to do, and you need to kind of do it and have become your wholly realized self. And I was worried that I just, you know, every relationship is different. I'm not happy with somebody who would be like, he stays home and plans trips and takes care of the house. Like, I knew that's not going to be satisfying. I also always feel like, to me, the last thing I did before I moved to LA was I was a bellman, you know, and there's always a part of me that's like, this could all go away tomorrow. And I'd be like, I'd work in a hotel again.
Back to the lobby.
To me, it feels like at some point in my life, you're going to see me at a supermarket checkout, ringing up groceries, and I'll be like, this feels right, that it would end, that I'd come back around. Do you know, in other words, like, I always felt like this is wonderful, but it's not who I am. And I wanted to be with somebody who found their own wonderful and did their own thing. And Brad, you know, he really, I think, understood that. And he kind of accomplished everything he accomplished in his own career on his own. And I don't work in the fashion world. I don't have any overlap there. And it was pretty, you know, wonderful to see him. So that was always alongside of our relationship, our different careers and building our own. So as a result, we have independent friends. We have independent trips we take. We have two lives. I have my life that's without him and my life that's with him, you know, and I think he has the same, and I think that's what's kept us, you know, together.
Of course, personally. It's like, you know, the whole, it's a different take on Whoopi Goldberg, I don't want somebody living in my house. But instead of that, it's, I don't want someone who is in every second part of my life that doesn't have any individuality without me. It's like you are two very passionate hardworking people that also have grown up together and individually. And that is what we like to call in the business inspiration. But unfortunately, Gary, we do have to get to the end of this gay ass interview. And I'm going to ask you a question to round us out. Gary Jannetty, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress. Who would you save?
Oh, well, that's a very easy question, Eric. Patty LuPone.
Everybody rise.
Yeah, Patty is going to be. Yeah, Patty's first.
Well, can you can you manifest to me now that Patty has given up her equity card? What is her next? What is her next big vehicle? Is she doing another Ryan Murphy moment? Is she gonna go back to Broadway? Is she?
Well, she is on Broadway this fall with Mia Farrow.
Oh, that's right.
She's gonna be on Broadway. I think it's called the play is titled The Roommate, which I will obviously be seeing.
Of course, with Mia Farrow of all people.
You know, Patty is somebody I think it is incumbent on all gays and all people, but especially our community. You know, when she's on Broadway, you go. You know, few people that have that kind of specialness. It's something that usually previous generations, you know, have. The fact that we still can see her on Broadway.
Oh, I know. And I wasn't going to admit this, but will you confirm that this is a safe space, Gary?
Yes, it is, Eric.
So before I knew better, I was my first or second year in New York in college, and Patty was doing Gypsy, and I kept putting it off, and I did not see her in Gypsy. And I have lived to regret that decision every day, because apparently her Mama Rose was transcendent.
Yeah, on your deathbed, the last thought you should have is, I really fucked up. Yeah.
Cue blackout. Eyes roll back in my head. And then Patty's alive at 180 years old. Gary, thank you so much for coming on. That's a Gay Ass Podcast. I'm going to, once more, for any of our girlies who are watching on YouTube, I'm holding up not only this most recent book that is so good, we are experiencing a slight delay, New York Times bestseller for a fucking reason. We also have Do You Mind If I Cancel? And we also have Start Without Me. Every single thing that you do, Gary Jannetty, I respect, I love, and I cannot tell you how grateful I am that you came on this podcast.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me. It was fun.
It's such an honor. Can you tell us?
Big surprise. It was fun. I was like, oh, it was. I was dreading this all week, but it was actually delightful.
Never not honest. Where do people follow you, Gary?
At Gary Jannetty.
Easy peasy lemon squeezy. Yeah. I'll see you at the next one, Gary. And God bless America.
Bye, Eric.
God, isn't Gary the best? I am so obsessed with him, endlessly grateful. But before I let you go, here is today's On This Gay Day. On this gay day in 1880, construction was completed on Cologne Cathedral after 800 years of construction. It's true. Some experts say it took 800 years because a gay ghost was haunting the workers by slapping tools out of their hands and saying, it's tacky, I hate it. He died in the great stained glass dildo debacle of 1282. Oh, just tragic. But for 800 years, workers claimed they saw him baiting in the pews, gooning in the belfry, and scatting in the choir loft. Happy anniversary, Cologne Cathedral. And bitch, you better stay arched, because you don't have to get arched if you stay arched. And that was today's On This Gay Day. God, I'm insane. Have an amazing rest of your week, gay-ass listeners, and I'll see you at the next one. Bye. You've been listening to That's a Gay-Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you're subscribed to us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Spotify, Apple Music, or Patreon at Gay-Ass Podcast. That's a Gay-Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.
Hold up. spring into big savings on all Larson storm doors now at Menards. Larson doors are perfect to enjoy the fresh spring air. Whether you're looking for additional security or a screen door, we have what you need. They come in over 40 styles and 9 colors to choose from. Check out all Larson storm door options in store and find more great deals in our weekly flyer on Menards.com.
Save big.